I wanted to start with a clarification about wild anomaly and conformal anomaly and things like that. So as I was saying, so a wild anomaly is something that manifests itself in a failure of the stress sensor to be traceless. Now, this can happen in a variety of different ways, which sometimes are called in different ways too. So the most general situation that can happen is that you have a theory which is naively scale invariant, even one invariant, but quantum mechanically turns out to be not well invariant, and not even invariant under just simpler transformations, like just scale transformation, uniform scale transformations. Your canonical example is QCD or even QED. You have things called beta functions. So the couplings are a function of your normalization scale. And these beta functions can actually be understood very directly as a statement that the trace of the stress tensor is non-zero and is proportional to some operators. Okay. If this happens, your wild symmetry is gone, your conformal symmetry is gone, you just have translations and rotations, the Lorentz group. Now, a milder situation is a situation where on the right-hand side, you don't have operators, I mean, non-trivial operators, but you just have something simpler, like just the identity, multiplied by some functions of the matrix, say, of the background fields. So you might have a situation where the right-hand side of the stress tensor is zero in flat space. But in a general curved space-time, it becomes non-zero. For example, you could have something like this in two dimensions. Okay. So this is a milder situation. In flat space, you don't even notice. If you do scale transformations, your theory is still invariant. It's even invariant if you do so-called conformal transformations, global conformal transformations, which are essentially what you get when you combine translations and inversion, the thing that sends distance to 1/distance from the origin. And we'll discuss global conformal transformations maybe better in a moment. But so when this happens, you say that there is a wild anomaly, but the theory is conformal invariant. And the theory, the free scalar fields in two dimensions, which we were discussing, were an example of that. Any questions?
Suppose you just consider flat space, then you won't have any anomalies.
Well, so the stress tensor will be traceless.
Okay.
So if you start making an infinitesimal wild transformation, you will not change the action of the conformal action. But then if you make a finite one, that make the curvature becomes non-zero, and you see a change. This change is controlled because you know how the partition function varies all along your wild transformation, but it's not clear.
But suppose we just stay in flat space, then do we have a local is the series still invariant?
Well, yes. So the modes of the stress tensor, for example, were still symmetric, but you see the anomaly in the fact that these symmetries are behaving in a non-trivial way. So when you see the Virasoro algebra, right, there is the usual, there is the trend that you would expect just from the coordinate transformations. And then there is this C over 12 and square minus 1, delta n plus n, 0. This then tells you that some things, including the stress tensor, that the stress tensor is transforming in a non-trivial way when you do conformal transformations because of the wild transformation that accompany them. There are some transformations in which this does not occur. If you just focus yourself on L minus 1, L0, and L1, we generate a so-called global transform, conformal transformations, their algebra is not changed. Because, as you see, this is not zero only for L2, L3, L4, and so on. This transformation generate transformations of this form on the plane. So they include scale transformations, translations, and other transformations you get out of those by inversion, which is z to minus 1 over z, z to 1 over z.
So in this case, if you really want a local transformation, we have to set
this function. Well, no, this is, you know, these are still generators, right?
Oh yeah.
You can still, they still give you work identities. The work, when you compute the work identities, you need to keep track of the factorless central charge, but you still get work identities. You still get consequences for these symmetries. Discuss BRC quantization in sort of more abstract terms, and then on Monday I would like to apply to string theory. Are there any more questions about what we did over the last few days? Because we're sort of changing gear for a moment, then we'll go back. Okay, I assume you, did you see some BRC quantization in QED or QCD? No, okay. So the BRC formalism is just a very convenient way to deal with theories which have gauge symmetries. Essentially, it can be used at a classical level in principle, usually you don't, but it's very particularly convenient at the quantum level. So there is a formalism called BRC quantization, which is a way to quantize theories with gauge symmetries. So naively, when you want to quantize a theory with gauge symmetry, what you want to do is to get rid of the gauge degrees of freedom. Except that's usually pretty tough. That's a very nonlinear thing to do, which doesn't work well with quantization. In the BRC formalism, instead of stripping off those degrees of freedom, you add extra degrees of freedom, whose job is to cancel the ones you don't want. There is a general philosophy that you can use fermions to cancel out bosons, or bosons to cancel out fermions. So roughly, you add some extra fermions, and then extra stuff until you manage to find a good balance, and all this extra stuff that you've added cancels out the effect of the gauge degrees of freedom. This careful cancellation is ensured by a symmetry. It's a symmetry that has to relate bosons and fermions to make sure that they cancel each other. So it's a fermionic symmetry. It has a generator. Let's call it Q. Sometimes it's also called QBRST. It's fermionic, and it has the property that Q squared vanishes. And a very big advantage of this procedure is that all sorts of subtleties that might occur in quantization come from infinite dimensional degrees of freedom, regularization of path integral, or whatever else, they are all captured into the requirement that this symmetry exists and squares to zero. So as long as you can manage to keep this true, the procedure goes through. And the gauge degrees of freedom are eliminated. And furthermore, there are pretty straightforward ways to argue that if you find different ways to do these, they're essentially going to be equivalent. So, for example, this formalism, when you do this formalism, you pick some gauge fixing condition, but it becomes pretty soon clear that the choice of gauge efficiency condition doesn't really matter. Different gauge efficiency conditions are equivalent as long as they do their job. Indeed, there is a sort of a close relationship between BRST formalism and cohomology. They are essentially the same thing, just with different names. So it's a way to get to somehow make some degrees of freedom topological. And I'll give a very concrete example in a moment. So the general philosophy is that once you have this sort of symmetry, and within some system, you're going to declare that the only things that are physical and that you can, the only questions you can ask, the only observables you can insert, are things that are invariant under this symmetry.
Is the BRST equivalent to the group de Boiler?
Sorry?
Is this equivalent to the group de Boiler formalization we talked about yesterday?
It's a better way to do it.
But it's effectively the same. Yeah.
It ends up giving you the same equations, although it fixes some ambiguities that might have occurred in group de Boiler. For example, you do this, there is no ambiguity of what was the value of A, how many dimensions did I need to have, and so on. It's all captured by this requirement. So this will fail if the dimension is not right. This will fail, this will produce for you the correct central charge, the correct Casimir energy to put in the expression for L0. So basically, when you do a correlation when you compute correlation functions in this formalism, you only consider observables which are too closed, which means they are annihilated by Q. They are invariant under Q. Furthermore, because Q squared equal to zero, everything which is of the form Q of something is automatically killed by Q, but is also trivial. If you put something like this in correlation functions of a theory which has BRST symmetry, they will vanish. Simply because having a symmetry means that if you have a correlation function and you act, yes?
I think there is some confusion. Q closed means that O stays O, right? So O becomes Q O is 0 or Q O is 0.
Sorry. Yes. Okay, so Q O equal to 0. Okay, let me call the observables F, okay? Okay, yes. Yeah, sorry, and of course when I say Q, I want Q close to mean that it's invariant under Q. I didn't mean that it's mapped to itself under Q. I meant that Q is the generator of an infinitesimal transformation. So this is invariant under 1 plus Q. OK. So having a symmetry essentially means that if you act with the symmetry on all the observables in your correlation function, and you add it up, you get 0. I put some plus minuses here because this is fermionic. So if for example, O1 is fermionic, when I carry this across, I need to put a minus sign because of anti-commutation relations. So I write it like this. Perhaps I should have better written the Q anti-commutator F equal to 0. And F is the anticommutator of Q and G. Because the way a symmetry acts on an operator typically is that you take your generator of the symmetry and you commute it, or anticommute it in the fermionic case, with your operators. But a formula like this still holds for states. So if the states that I'm interested in the theory, will be, again, states which are annihilated by Q, and states which are in the image of Q will be uninteresting. So I'll use the terminology Q close and Q exact, both for operators and for states, and for anything else. In any case, it always means the action of Q, the natural action of Q on that object.
By the curly and square bracket, do you mean like different signs for fermions and bosons?
Yes, I really was going to put. You're right that I should have really written it.
That's what it means.
Yeah, let me just write it. I don't know which notation to use. Let me just use curly brackets. We can pick whatever conventions we like. Let's say that the what convention can I use? Maybe I should not use a convention. Okay, so we're with the degree of an object, I mean the fermion number of that object. Okay, so this is a commutator for a bosonic object, an anticommutator for a fermionic object. So as I was saying, because this holds, now if everything in my correlation function was closed, except for something that was exact, then this will vanish because this vanishes, and everything else vanishes. So exact objects inserted in the correlation function vanish. And so the spaces, the true space of states of your theory is going to be Q closed modulo Q exact. The true space of operators of your theory is going to be Q closed modulo Q exact. So something called the Q cohomology. Is the whatever space of things that are Q closed modulo things that are Q exact. Okay. So so for example, when we study string theory and we want to study the space of string states, instead of writing down those equations that were telling us that the states should be highest weight with a specific eigenvalue of L naught, modulo things that are descendants, we're going to say we want states which are Q closed modulo Q exact. Then we check what it means, and we find the same equations with a very specific value of A. But an advantage of this is that, for example, if I pick different choices of gauge fixing, I might have a different looking theory with a different looking space of Q closed things and Q exact things, but the Q cohomology will be the same, no matter what gauge fixing I did. Okay. So, let me give you the simplest example of a situation where fermions are canceling as bosons. I'm sorry, this is becoming a comedy. Okay. So this is essentially the simplest example of cohomology. So I'm going to take a bunch of bosonic coordinates and a bunch of fermionic coordinates. And I'm going to say Q of x gives me theta, Q of theta equals 0. So Q squared vanishes. Yeah, by the way, although we're going to apply this quantum field theories, most features of this are already visible in finite dimensional examples. So now I'm not trying to describe a quantum field theory or even a quantum mechanics. I'm just going to talk about integrals, zero-dimensional quantum field theories. Think so the partition function is just the integral of something instead of a path integral. So I can impose this. This exercise can be just a bunch of variables in R. They could also be local coordinates on a manifold. Suppose that I have a coordinate transformation that send xi to some x tilde i's of my old x's. Okay? So if I define my theta tildes to be just related to the usual thetas by a Jacobian, then these relations will hold for the x tildes and q tildes and theta tildes. So literally, if you take q of x tilde equals theta tilde, and q of theta tilde is 0. So that means that I can patch this system up together on a whole manifold. The thetas transform pretty much like vector field, like components of a vector field, except that they are fermionic. So the total, if I denote my manifold as x, then the x's and thetas together are part of parametrized something which is sometimes denoted as the fermionic version of the cotangent band, of the tangent bundle of x. I just call it x. Now, the partition function or correlation functions will be integrals over the thetas and the x's of some observables. Mm-hmm. That's right.
What is pi?
Pi usually means take the bundle and make it fermionic. So it's something called a superspace where some of the coordinates are bosonic and some fermionic. Okay. So I will define correlation functions of some observables as just the integral over this of some functions of x and theta. Notice when I integrate over a manifold, usually I need to put some measure. You know, for example, I might pick a metric and put a square root of g here. But here I don't need to, because if you remember the rules of Grassmann, did you see Grassmann integrals? Okay, so if you remember the rules of Grassmann integrals, you remember that they transform with the opposite power of the Jacobian compared to bosonic variables. But Jacobian for the transformation of the thetas is precisely the Jacobian for the transformation of the x's. So this measure equals the x tilde, the theta tilde. So it's just well defined without any need to pick a metric, pick some density.
The O's are the local operator?
Yes, are the operators. There is no notion of local because everything is zero dimensional, this is the point. they're just functions of my fields.
Functions of the field. So, can we get some menu to X and theta here?
Hmm?
Can we get some, what is it, physical interpretation of X and theta here? Like, I thought the X is some kind of position, right?
No, these are just some variables.
Just a variable?
Yes, right. So I'm trying to describe a zero-dimensional quantum field theory of maps from a point somewhere. So this is analogous to a scalar field, and this is a strange scalar field, which is fermionic, something called a Gauss. So instead of doing a path integral, I'm just doing an integral over x's and thetas. Now notice that this is this is a symmetry of this integral. How do I check it? There is a neat way which should be useful for other purposes too. How does the generic operator look like? How does the generic function of x and theta look like? Well, it's a function of x, and it's going to be a polynomial in the thetas, pretty much by definition. So you can sum over all possible numbers of thetas you can put, and put theta I1 all the way to theta IN, and then something here. Let me put some, I can guess I can still call it O I1 IN, especially if I change my notation slightly and put these indices up. Okay, and this is still a function of x. Is this clear? Okay, now you can identify this with a differential form. So I can map this to a differential form FO, which is just sum of dx I1 all the way to dx IN, or I1 to IN x. See, the differentials behave precisely the same way as the thetas. Indeed, I could have called them all, I could have called them the x's, right? And then this would have been completely obvious. But it can get confusing. So when you see a theta, you really should think about one form, a basis for one forms. Now, with this identification, then you should be able to see pretty easily that this is simply the integral over x of the corresponding forms. Why? Because the integral over the thetas is just removing the thetas from the operators and leaves behind these expressions anti-symmetrized over all their indices. And then you integrate them.
Yeah, but you have a mix of forms there, right?
Hmm?
So a mix of the number of...
That's right. So this is going to be zero unless there is just the right number of ghosts to cancel the number of theta.
But is the integral then really fine? If you take this integral like a, you know, p form over a q...
It's by definition zero.
Okay.
Now, you could complain that this is not much of a quantum field theory if I cannot even compute the correlation function of 1. That's true. We'll improve that momentarily. Although this happens once you start putting in ghosts. This happens all the time. And it's actually a very important phenomenon. You can define a quantum number, which is called ghost number. Which is just the number of thetas you have in your expression. And it's a conserved quantity. You know, you multiply operators, the ghost number adds. But your partition, your correlation functions might be, might require you to have a total ghost number which is not zero, which is not something that would happen with a good conserved charge. So what happens is this ghost number somehow has an anomaly, the measure is not invariant under ghost number, something it has no zero Gauss number. So you could define a symmetry which just takes theta and rotates it, and takes Q and rotates it. Under this symmetry, would say theta has charge 1, Q has charge 1. But the problem is that this symmetry does not leave the measure invariant. OK. So now, once you believe this equality, then it's easy to see that the integral of Q of something vanishes, because the integral of Q of O is the same as the integral of DF. Sorry. I'm behind. I'm one formula behind. Sorry. Now, using this identification, how does Q act on operator? Let's compute it. So what is Q of O? Am I even supposed to write on the thing in back? So how does Q act on O of X and theta? So I can take the Q, I can act on the first theta, I get 0. I can move it across, act on the second theta, I get 0, and so on, all the way until here. Let me say that I put this guy here, it's bosonic anyway. So acting on the theta doesn't give me anything. Acting on O gives me the derivative with respect of X. So I get theta of I1 all the way to theta of IN, theta of IN plus 1, dO over dx, IN plus 1. OK.
Mm-hmm. So in writing this, you're assuming that Q satisfies some sort of product rule, right?
Yes, I'm assuming that Q is an operator. That's right. So that's true. I should have taken this as a definition of how Q acts on complicated things. You're perfectly right. Q of AB is Q of A times B plus minus 1 to the degree of A QB. Thank you. This is a big assumption. If you want, this is my definition of how Q acts on operators. At least this works on polynomials of X. Then I can extend it farther to say that Q of F of X is just df over dx theta. Okay, so let's take it as a definition. When I write that, I implicitly have these and these in mind, and I should have made it explicit. Q acts in a completely analogous way to any other symmetry generator, except for these crucial signs which pop out when you bring it across things.
But it's really like the exterior derivative, right? So if you...
That's right. So punchline of this. Yeah. The thetas, the indices of the thetas are anti-symmetrized, because these are anti-commute. So this is precisely... So F of Q of O is D of F of O. So the one at level of forms, Q acts like the sphere derivative. This definition of the sphere derivative. Remember that the sphere derivative satisfies indeed the square equal to zero, it satisfies Leibniz relations, and so on and so forth. And it acts on functions as the gradient.
Well, why didn't we just say Q is a differential form from the beginning?
I could have.
Is there anything that differs from? No.
As I said, the RST formalism is really just a different name to call cohomology. But it could be this cohomology. There are a variety of possible cohomology theories, and there is a variety of possible ways to set up your VRST symmetry. For example, so momentarily we'll get to the one that you use in gauge fixing, which is something called Lyapunov cohomology. Okay, so in particular, because of this, it means that the integral of Q of O is the same as the integral of DF, which is zero. By Stokes theorem. I'm assuming that my manifold is compact, or if the manifold is not compact, that my observables decay fast enough as you go to infinity. If those conditions fail, then the system does not have VRST symmetry, because Q is not a symmetry of my correlation functions. Now, if you look at this expression and you remember what you know about differential forms, you can see why, in which sense the VRST symmetry is canceling degrees of freedom against each other. See, suppose now I restrict myself to Q closed operators modulo Q exact. Q closed is just precisely the same as just closed forms, modulo exact forms. Q cohomology is simply cohomology. This operation is simply the integral of cohomology classes over your manifold. And it's a completely topological thing. You can take your cohomology class, deform it by exact amounts, and this answer doesn't change. And the cohomology of your manifold really captures topological information about the manifold. You can take your manifold, you can change it in various ways, and the cohomology will remain the same. So essentially what we have done, we're taking this manifold of X's, and by adding fermionic thetas, we have erased all the local information about the manifold. All that is left is some global information about what shape does it have, how many holes, how many non-trivial cycles. And this is here's a general theme.
This formalism, is it easy to see why physical results will be independent of the theta, the ghosts?
So, when
we quantize this way, you can like draw diagrams, find diagrams, you show the ghost fields don't really, they all drop out. Like, mm-hmm. how can you see in this formalism that this is the results you get will be independent of the thetas you added?
Well, they're not independent of the theta sign. It's definitely important that I added the thetas.
Like you said, there are extra unphysical degrees of freedom that are used to cancel the gauge.
Yeah, so in this case, it's like I wanted to study my manifold,
but
actually I wanted to just study the topology of my manifold. The local information would just a gauge freedom. I wanted to study curves, surfaces, objects in my manifold, but not really the precise location inside the manifold. And this did it. The thetas canceled the information about precise location. Now,
which part, like, does the theta cancel the information about the precise location? See, like, how this thing works.
Well, it's not a very precise
statement. There's some location in this equation.
Let me see. For example, suppose that my manifold is a circle. Okay. What sort of observables do I have? I have observables without thetas or observables with one theta. The only closed observables without thetas are constant functions. So they cannot keep track of information about where things are in the manifold. And then the only non-trivial ones with one theta are long forms, right? Are something like f of a function of the circle called x. Let me just write it in the form. But most of them are exact. Right? The only ones which are not exact, the only non-exact information here, the only non-trivial information that is left is what is the contour integral of, what is the integral from 0 to 2 pi of f of x dx. This is something which is not sensitive to the exact ones. It tells you how many times does this wind around, right? So again, you've lost every ability to talk about the points. You can only keep track of how many times this one form goes around the circle.
In this analogy, what is your gauge field that you're trying to remove the x degrees of freedom from? I guess I'm thinking.
I can answer this question. So in this example, I want to treat diffeomorphisms of the manifold as a gauge symmetry. So I introduce the theta for each infinitesimal translation on my manifold. I'm not sure this is a 100% correct answer, but it's correct enough. At least in the sense that I think it's a true statement that now I'm only keeping the diffeomorphism invariant information. Okay, but we'll get hopefully closer to the gauge theory in a moment. I want to just add one more ingredient. So here, as I said, we don't even have a partition function. And I need to supply everything by hand. Now, it's interesting to imagine adding yet another set of degrees of freedom to this. So here I had bosons which transforms into fermions. Another thing I could do is to add a fermion and a boson, and say that the fermion transforms into the boson, and the boson transforms to nothing. Okay? Now, the reason is interesting is that this allows me to introduce some interesting extra act. Let's say, it allows me to do things like this. To take the integral over the x's and thetas with the b and b now, but add something like this to the measure. Q of something. So what is Q of B F of X? This is capital B F of X plus minus B theta I D I F. Okay? So suppose that my the observables that I'm inserting still only depend on x and thetas for simplicity. But surely they don't want to depend on b, otherwise they're not going to be closed. They could be functions of capital B, and we'll discuss what that means. But for simplicity, let's say that b, little b, and capital B only enter through this Michaelisian function. Then I can just do the integral. And what do I get? The integral of capital B gives me a delta function. And integral over little b gives me a one form. Now you might have seen something like this before. So now I have integrals where I have my observables, and I've inserted by hand, I've inserted a delta function that restricts me the location f of x equal to 0, and the one form perpendicular to that hypersurface. Well, this is pretty much the same as an integral over the locus f equal to 0. Doing this restricts me to the manifold and projects and makes sure that the measure and everything else is now adequate for this submanifold. So by adding this to the action, I managed to restrict my study of the manifold to a study of a submanifold. I could have put several b's instead of just one b. And again, this has been done in a topological manner. Okay? I didn't need a measure or anything, or a metric or anything like that in the bigger manifold. I don't need it in the submanifold. This is sort of automatically pulling back my forms on the to the submanifold and integrating them there. And notice that now I need one less theta in my observables. So I've ameliorated a little bit the problem with Gauss number symmetry. Essentially, what's going on is that the little b's have Gauss number minus 1, and the measure of the little b's is helping cancel the problems of the measure of the thetas. If I put enough little b's, at some point I'll get something where even the integral of 1 is well-defined. That will happen when I put so many b's that they are constraining me to live at points. So right, the most obvious generalization is to add a set of b variables which transform like this. I can imagine that you actually live in some non-trivial bundle over my manifold. So I could say that, I could postulate, for example, that if I change coordinates, my b's must be transformed in some way. And I derive a similar transformation for the capital B's just by requiring these relations to hold. Okay. So these bosonic variables get an extra shift by a bilinear of fermions. So if I do that, and I pick a bunch of functions on the manifold, or better, a section of this, or the bundle dual to this, I can add now an action, which is just Q of BF. And then the partition function, the collection function, will essentially become integrals over the locus where the f's are zero. And if you could put mathematical names to this, some Euler class of some bundle, something like that, I will refrain to do so. It's getting pretty late. But we have seen more or less the basic ingredients we need. This sort of gadget makes some directions topological. This sort of gadget picks some points in those topological directions. So intuitively, to do the BRST quantization of gauge theories, we are going to use some of these to make the gauge directions topological, and some of these to pick one point in the gauge orbits, or in any way to forget about the topology of the gauge orbits, to just localize somewhere, to just impose gauge fixing. So we're going to use these to impose gauge fixing, and that to make sure that everything is done topologically.
So this capital B tilde M, is that a definition, or is that obtained from acting Q on little b tilde?
The second.
So where's the theta come from, the theta?
Well, when Q acts on X,
oh,
it pulls down theta. OK. Now, of course, if we want to get rid of gauge directions, perhaps you don't want to get rid of the whole manifold. So perhaps you should add a bit fewer thetas.
When we did this in PFT2, we introduced ghost fields to do some gauge fixing for Yang-Mills theory.
Yes.
And but we did this perturbatively because there's this group of ambiguity. Is that removed in BRST because of some topological reasons, or is that still present?
Honestly, in a sense, the BRST formalism doesn't really require it to cut every gauge orbit exactly once. It's much more forgiving. As I said, things are topological. They count things like intersection numbers. So for example, if you have a gauge orbit that looks like that, and your gauge fixing cut it like this, and somewhere else your gauge fixing does like that, it's no big deal. At the end, this will count as 1, this counts as 1 minus 1, 1, and you still get 1. So per se, the fact that at some point the gauge fixing stops being 1 to 1 should not be a big deal. Okay. Now, what should be a big deal is if Q fails to square to 0. So if this grid of problems turn out to actually give you a failure of Q square equal to 0 non-perturbatively, then I would get worried. But it's not enough to say, oh, the gauge fixing condition was not cutting things well. It's a very robust formalism.
BRST formalism only guarantees that you reduce everything up to delta fx, which could give you affect gauge fixing. But it doesn't mean that gauge fixing will give you the physical correlation function.
Well, we haven't gauge fixed yet because I've not introduced the full formalism yet. But this definitely is fixing the calculation to happen at f equal to 0.
Okay.
Like this problem is sort of happens only when you choose a bad app, but which kind of app you choose doesn't depend on the BISD formalism. The formalism only guarantees that you can make that expression to this.
Well, maybe I should mention, suppose that I take other Fs in the same bundle, sections of the same bundle, which I'll obtain from this one by some continuous deformation, the answer will be the same. Why? Because, thank you, today, for some reason, I keep missing to, is it over there? Yes, up there. So, see, I wrote the action and it was Q exact, right? What does it mean? Suppose I vary F a little bit. I'm pulling down something Q exact in my correlation function, but it vanishes. There's a crucial point that I should definitely mention. So the fact that the dependence on the F and the gauge fixing was exact means that the precise choice of F was actually irrelevant. Whatever, as long as F has more or less two Fs have the same topological properties, they'll give me the same answer. Here, in a picture like this, if I picked a different F, this is F equal to zero, suppose I have an F tilde equal to zero, and it does something else, doesn't matter, the final answer is going to be the same. The net number of times this intersects this is one, the net number of times this intersects this is one. So that's why the BRST symmetry will make independence on gauge fixing quite manifest. As long as so if you do very drastic changes to gauge fixing, then you need to be careful. You need to make sure that you can interpolate between them without breaking BRST symmetry at intermediate steps. But if your manifold is non-compact and you change very dramatically the behavior of F at infinity, you might get a different answer. You know, if your F doesn't go here at all and does like this, then you get a different answer.
But what happens if you choose F with, like, for example, different topological properties? For example, like a winded, like, suppose it's the field theory space is a torus and I wind around twice.
Then instead of one, you get two.
Yeah.
But it's going to be different. It will differ by normalization, which doesn't really depend on the degrees of freedom. So there will be some overall number in front of the partition function. Now, of course, if the number becomes infinity and is an infinity you cannot get rid of, you might start worrying. But as long as things make sense and Q squares to zero, you're pretty safe. You might still want to check that, for example, you don't get the theory that you obtain is unitary. Okay, if Q squares to zero, but my theory is not unitary, I still fail. But as I said, the formalism is robust. That's all I want to say. I'm not an expert, for example, about the Grieber problem. I do worry when I hear about it. Sometimes people might be overly worried. So, there was one little gadget I wanted to introduce, and then I'll let you go, sorry. But I started 5 minutes late. So, suppose I don't want to get rid of all the x's, but only of some of them. Okay? So what I can do is to modify those equations and say that Q of x is some vector field, times some ghosts. Okay, this is more or less the most general thing I can do. The thing on the right-hand side must have an index like coordinates do. It might depend on x. And it have, I'm assuming it depends linearly on these ghosts. Okay? Now, suppose I look at q square of x now. What I get two terms. I get v contracted with q of c. And I get the derivative of V contracted with another V contracted with two C's. Now, the C is anti-commute, so I should really anti-symmetrize over A and B. You might recognize this as the Lie bracket. Okay. So remember, for example, if you have a group action, a Lie algebra action on a manifold, so some Lie algebra which acts on the manifold via vector fields, associated to Lie algebra elements, then this expression called the Lie bracket gives you the vector field of the bracket of the two Lie algebra elements. So this, if I have some group action on the manifold, this tells me how the group relations work.
The derivative, does it act on both of the Bs? Hmm? The derivative, does it act on
both? No, only on one.
Okay.
So in terms of structure constants for my Lie algebra, I'm justified in writing this as F A B C V I C. Essentially by definition. So this, if this vector field was a sort of symmetry of my manifold, the Lie bracket is another vector field which is also a symmetry of my manifold. So if I put all my symmetries here, I should be able to write something like that. Which means I can make Q squared equal to zero by picking Q of C to be F A B C C B C C. So the difference with respect to what happened over there is that if I have an abelian isometry that I'm trying to make topological, my C's also need to transform. And you can check that now if you do check Q squared C equal to zero, that just follows from the definition of the Jacobian identity for the Lie algebra. Yes?
When you're calculating u squared xi,
yes.
Can you explain the plus sign, what's the degree here, why it's not plus to minus sign when you're applying the product rule?
So v had degree 0, c had degree 1. So
right.
This is bosonic, this is fermionic. So when I plot, I can freely bring q across v. And then, of course, there's also the term which Q acts on V. It acts by a derivative contracted with this. And oh, sorry, you are perfectly right. This should have been V and this should have been A. Thank you.
So you use that to cancel out the minus sign from the product rule?
That's right. Okay. That's right. Sorry for the typo. Okay, so this sort of setup allows you to make only some gauge directions topological. Okay, now, so now I can write down the okay, so usually in the textbooks, when you see the BRST symmetry, the BRST quantization derived, the starting point is some integral. Okay. And which you want to make into an integral over gauge orbits only. So typically you want to put a delta function which enforces some gauge fixing condition. And then you need some sort of Jacobian which make sure that you're counting every gauge orbit in the same way. So the way you can, so the, what people do is they take this delta function, they rewrite it as a Fourier transform. They take this Jacobian, they write it as an integral of some fermionic bilinear. So the final expression is the same that will come out of this theory. When you have an action, which is going to be added to whatever action you had before, which is essentially just, again, Q of B F. Okay. So Q of B F gives you, again, capital BF, which enforces the delta function, and then something bilinear in the Bs and Cs. Okay.
S of X is your original action.
Yeah, S of X is whatever action you had before gauge fixing. So notice that if I have some function of x only, it will be Q invariant as long as it's gauge invariant. So as long as my original action was gauge invariant, this is Q closed. And this Q is a symmetry of my theory. Q is a symmetry of this expression. And the part that I've added to gauge fix is Q exact, which means that changes in my gauge fixing are not going to change the final answer of my calculations. The thing, the integral over B gives you the delta function, the integral over B and C gives you the Jacobian. And I refer you to the quantum field theory textbooks for the standard way to justify this and arrive here. But I would prefer you to just understand what is the logical meaning of the various pieces of this complicated beast. There are some, the Cgos are added in order to make the gauge directions topological, and the B and capital B fields are added in order to do the gauge fixing, to fix some location inside this topological direction. So altogether, these degrees of freedom conspire to cancel the gauge directions. Now, when we do string theory, we'll have to use a couple substitutes which are usually not mentioned, but are very straightforward in this language. So usually, when you do gauge fixing, in any ideal situation, you would like your gauge conditions to completely fix your gauge symmetry. But you really don't have to do that, and sometimes you can't. Sometimes, the gauge fixing condition you would like to impose is a little bit too strong. Sometimes it's a little bit weaker. Now, it's not a big deal if you leave some finite dimensional gauge symmetry. For example, you can probably deal with it by hand. Or, so in string theory, for example, we know that we can try to gauge fix with homomorphism in wild by taking the metric to be flat. We also know that we cannot do this globally, right? In our first lectures, our objective was to divide metrics but measure by diffeomorphism in wild and end up with a finite dimensional integral over complex structures on the Riemann surface. So in order to do that, we cannot just say, OK, I want my metric to be flat. That's going to fail. What I can do is I want my metric to be one representative of possible complex structures. So I want a situation where I have some parameter space of complex structures, say, and I want to impose the gauge condition up to some choice of these parameters. In a sense, when I define an hypersurface by f equal to 0, it's nice, but sometimes I can't. Sometimes I need to use parametric equations. I need to say, OK, my surface is defined by f of x and t equal to 0, where t is left free to vary. That's a possibility. Now, how do I deal with this? Well, I simply make this direction topological too. I'm going to add yet another variable to my VRST situation. Okay. And then when I write my Q of BF of X and T, I'm going to get an extra term, which is something like tau df over the t. And then when I have the tau dt integral of e to the s, if tau doesn't enter anywhere else, this just becomes something like df over dt. Sorry, there was a b here too, still. B df over dt inserted in my integral. So the way the BST formalism deals with these situations is that when you do your gauge, when you gauge fix your integral, you're left with an integral over your parameters. To do the integral, you need a measure, you need something, you need a form over your parameter space, and the BST formalism produces this form for you by this trick. So when we studied string theory path integral, we learned that we had to insert a bunch of b's in such a way to get a form on our space of complex structures, which you can then integrate and get a good answer. And there are other situations in which I need to put a few more c insertions whenever there are some gauge freedoms which I did not fix with my gauge fixing and I need to fix by hand. Okay, I'll repeat these things in more detail when we need them, but I just wanted to mention this. Okay.